I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Last week, President Trump accused Canada of taking advantage of U.S. trade policies. He said what they have done to our dairy farmers is a disgrace. He also said they've hurt timber and lumber jobs, and he promised to deal with this at the negotiating table. Criticizing trade deals was a big applause line for candidate Trump. And now, 3 months in office, can he turn a campaign promise into policy? We asked Neil Irwin to join us. He's senior economics correspondent for the New York Times. He writes for The Upshot, wrote a book called The Alchemists. And Neil Irwin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
The president pulled the U.S. out of the TPP. Is NAFTA on the chopping block now that Canada is in his crosshairs?
I think chopping block is too strong. I don't see evidence that we're going to get a really complete, the kind of threats of the U.S. actually leaving NAFTA or something along those lines. That said, you know, we are going to see a more assertive stance than a United States willing to take on negotiations, take on challenges that, maybe are issues that have been out there for a long time, but have been lingering out there. And I think that's what we see with both Canada, certainly with steel and China. And that seems to be the tone we're getting so far.
Do you know what Canada has done to our dairy farmers?
I mean, it's, you know, there are a lot of these disputes with dairy. It's advantaging their dairy producers over our Wisconsin dairy farms. The dispute is how much are we willing to risk? How much is the United States willing to risk to try and get a better deal on some of these things? I mean, with Canada, there was a softwood lumber dispute that lasted for years and years and years. I mean, there was a joke in D.C. that it put trade lawyers' kids through college, the softwood lumber dispute with Canada. So these things can go on for a long time, and I think we're seeing kind of as the Trump administration gets its footing and tries to figure out what its real priorities are, they're deciding that Canada and dairy is at the top of that list.
NAFTA is, what, 20 years old? It goes back to the Clinton administration. Do you think it is time to at least revisit it and if not pull out or make dramatic changes, at least tweak it and fine-tune it for the 21st century?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you say, this is a deal that's closer to 25 years old. It was passed in 1993. There's plenty of stuff that can be updated. The problem, the thing you have to remember, though, is any negotiation along those lines, it'll involve give and take. And it's not as if the United States can go in and, you know, threaten to pull out and then just get all the things that U.S. interests might want. There are some things that U.S. interests might want. You know, get better e-commerce access to Mexico and Canada, for example. But to get some of those things, we'll have to give something, too. And U.S. trade with Canada and Mexico, it's, you know, there's an integrated North American economy. If you're an automaker, you have a lot to lose. If suddenly we rip up these trade links with Mexico and Canada, if you're Ford or GM or one of the U.S. automakers, really any kind of industrial company in the United States, you have a lot to lose if things really go awry and we get into a true trade war with these countries.
Is that because parts of cars are made in places like Mexico?
Yes. So, you know, if you're, when you buy an American car, a car made in the United States, it might have parts from Canada, from Mexico, from Asia. You know, an engine might cross the border with Canada, you know, 3, 4, 5, 7 times in the course of the making of a car. Now, it's not that you couldn't undo some of those supply chains, but it would be very disruptive. And it could really, you know, if you're worried about manufacturing jobs, these supply chains are the engine of manufacturing jobs. And the fact that the U.S. plays a role as part of an entire North American economy is a really important idea. But I think if you read between the lines, the Trump administration is figuring out, you know, some of this doesn't quite comport with his rhetoric on the campaign trail, but as they get into office and actually have to figure out how to turn some of these ideas into policy, they're realizing, if we really mess up the supply chain, that's actually bad for American workers, not good for them.
He has talked about buying American, hiring American. Now, we know some of these Trump products are not made in America, but nonetheless, Neil, I mean, could we afford a toaster or a TV, a car, a pair of shoes if we bought American and hired American?
Well, you know, the thing to remember is every person is both a producer and a consumer. It's great to say, you know, we want more American jobs, higher incomes, let's, you know, put up tariffs and try and reduce trade. But, you know, first of all, it's debatable how much that would actually create in terms of jobs and incomes. But the one thing that is absolutely certain is that it would raise the price of consumer goods. So to the degree we're all both consumers and producers, it's not at all clear that you'd have, you know, the country would be better off if we did that. And I think we're not seeing that, you know, now that he's in office, we're not seeing that out of President Trump. We're not seeing a desire to, you know, he floated on the campaign a 45% tariff on goods from China. You notice we haven't heard anything about that since he's been president. And I think the reason is he has people around him telling him, you know, this would be really bad bad for American consumers. People who voted for you would suddenly not be able to afford the things they consume every day if we did this kind of policy.
Well, let's talk about China. He met recently with the Chinese president. I was reading that our China's trade surplus with the U.S. is something like $350 billion. Now, I don't know, is that considered a lot of money when it comes to a trade for China surplus, for us deficit?
It is. Yeah, you know, look, the U.S. economic relationship with China, it's messy, it's problematic. You know, to the degree the U.S. is running persistent current account deficits and China is running persistent current account surpluses, it's a problem over time. The problem is, there's a lot of dimensions of this relationship. It's not just a simple trade relationship. It's also diplomatic. So, for example, out of Trump, we've heard his realization that he needs China to play an assertive role in trying to contain North Korea. And, you know, is he going to slap a 45% tariff on Chinese goods at a time when he's looking for Chinese cooperation on diplomatic goals, for example? And that's just one example of the many ways in which the U.S. and China are intertwined. It's a little bit of a codependent relationship, and you can't just tear that apart at a moment's notice.
In fact, you wrote before the president of China came to visit the president of the United States at Mar-a-Lago, you wrote in the New York Times, the world's biggest and second biggest economies are like a married couple that complain about each other constantly, yet can't even contemplate a divorce. So a week or so after their meeting, how would you describe this relationship?
Well, I think it's, if anything, stronger. I mean, that visit went well, and if what you want is favorable, close relations between the United States and China, that visit that President Xi did at Mar-a-Lago was very effective. They seemed to get along. They seem to have a sense of some cooperation on North Korea, and who knows where this will go. This is early in the Trump administration; anything could happen. But this is not a situation where President Trump is just saying, let's rip it apart and go at him. Now, that said, he did last week, raise the issue of steel in China. And China has all this excess capacity in steel. There's an accusation, the Trump administration actually did it on national security grounds. The argument is that by undermining U.S. steel production, that actually undermines U.S. national security. A lot of trade experts are skeptical of that theory of the case, but that is, a sign that it's not all happiness and light. Just because that visit went well a couple of weeks ago doesn't mean the U.S. and China are buddies on everything.
Is China a currency manipulator?
It has been. Right now, it really isn't. I mean, right now, if anything, China is intervening to try and keep the value of its currency from declining too much. It seems like Trump has finally gotten this message. During the campaign, he said, I'll declare China a currency manipulator on day one. They manipulate their currency, make it too cheap. That disadvantages U.S. exporters, U.S. companies. He finally got the message. That information was outdated. That was true 10 years ago. It was true 8 years ago. In 2017, that's not really the issue with China. And so you've noticed the president his Treasury Department did not call China a currency manipulator, and that has kind of been dropped from the president's rhetoric.
Is there a difference between there are these multilateral deals. I mean, TPP is a multilateral deal. It looks like the president is more interested in bilateral deals, at least when it comes to, I know China wasn't part of TPP, but at least when it comes to future trade deals. Are there pros and cons?
Yeah, I mean, to be frank, I don't totally understand why the administration, why Trump dislikes multilateral deals so much. There are a lot of things that you can get when you do these big complicated deals like TPP that you can't get one-on-one. So, for example, when the United States is negotiating with Mexico, there are concessions the United States got out of Mexico during the TPP negotiations because Mexico wanted better trade with Japan and with the rest of Asia. You don't get those when it's bilateral. Part of this kind of feeds into the president's conception of himself as this great deal maker who thinks he can go in and negotiate things. But, these countries they have good deal makers themselves. They all, they're not going to make unilateral concessions. If you're doing a one-on-one trade deal, you're going to have to, again, to get something, you have to give something. And I think the president's learning that.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that will be or might be or could be happening this week in Washington. There is at least a deadline this Friday, a potential, hopefully not, but a government shutdown. The president also wants, $21 billion, something like that, for the wall along the Mexican border. What's the status of all of this?
Well, Democrats feel like they have a pretty good hand here. The president needs some Democratic votes to keep the government open, and you know they're saying no, we're not gonna vote for something that involves funding for this wall that you know we think is a bad idea and a waste of money. It's interesting. Even among Republicans, a lot of the Republicans who represent areas around the border are not terribly excited about the wall. If you the Wall Street Journal was some reporting on that last week. This is a complicated thing. I think that the question is, there could just be a continuing resolution to keep the government funded and basically keep the status quo for a few weeks. Regardless of what happens on that, for the long term, you know, is there a pathway for the president to get something he can claim victory on that Democrats are okay with and aren't going to, you know, try and block? You know, is there
what
a way
would that
to,
be? What would that be?
Allowing some money for border security that isn't literally building a giant wall, but is kind of a virtual wall, involves, you know, drones and various ways of trying to protect the border, which, you know, the border experts tell us is really the smarter approach for a lot of parts of the border. You know, a wall isn't actually the most effective way to try and reduce illegal immigration in most parts of the border. So it seems like there are pathways, if this is a priority for the president, where he can proclaim victory, but it doesn't literally involve a giant wall, on the Rio Grande.
Seems like he surprised a lot of people, I think including his Treasury Secretary, that there's going to be some big tax proposal this Wednesday, a really big tax cut for everybody. Neil, what do we know about this?
Yeah, this is kind of the president's style. He keeps everybody off guard, including his own staff. Right. You know, the Treasury Department, the economic advisors in the White House were not ready to roll out a tax plan this week, but the president said in an interview on, I believe, Thursday that's what they were going to do.
Is that possible to come up with a tax plan?
You can roll out bullet points. There's a difference between kind of a concept and an idea. I mean, I could sit here at my desk and come up with a tax plan. That doesn't mean it's all vetted, that the politics has worked through, that the financing has worked through. So there's a big difference between a set of bullet points that sound good and an actual tax plan. And I think it's unlikely they'll have an actual tax plan where they really have a plausible path to passing it in this kind of short time frame.
If we're talking about tax cuts for everybody, does that say that deficits don't matter for the Trump administration?
I mean, it's a reasonable judgment. I mean, they have an interesting tension here. If they try and do if they want to make tax cuts permanent, what they need to do is find offsets and find, lower the rate, broaden the base is a cliche among tax experts. And the idea is you lower the tax rate on either companies or individuals, but you reduce deductions, eliminate, you get rid of some of the things that distort the tax code. But anybody who benefits from those deductions is going to fight that. So if you're, on the individual side of the tax code, if you eliminate the state and local income tax deduction, anybody from a high state with high taxes is going to hate that. New York, California, you name it. If you try and eliminate the charitable interest deduction, charities are going to go crazy. Nobody's going to like it. If you try and eliminate the home mortgage interest deduction, all the housing-related industries are going to go crazy. There's no free lunch here.
Well, Neil Irwin, thank you for shoehorning all that material into our 12 and a half minutes, and thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Senior economics correspondent for the New York Times. He writes for The Upshot. After this very short break, we want to know about your shopping habits. Call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. And stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, while the job market has been improving, the retail sector has taken a hit in recent months. Sears, JCPenney, and Macy's are in the process of closing stores that have often been anchors at shopping malls, making them feel more like ghost towns. There's even a new phrase, zombie malls. Add to that the retail behemoth Amazon that's been changing consumer habits and putting pressure on brick and mortar stores. Well, today in Radio Times, the state and the future of the retail industry, we have two guests who are at the NPR studios in New York. David Bell is marketing professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, wrote a book called "Like Location is Still Everything, The Surprising Influence of the Real World on How We Search, Shop, and Sell in the Virtual One." David Bell, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Marty. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Derek Thompson with us as well. He's senior editor for The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, author of a book called The Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. And Derek Thompson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Derek, let me begin with you. How important is retail shopping to the overall U.S. economy? We're often told that consumer shopping or spending accounts for something like 70% of our economy. How does that factor in when we're talking about retail?
Well, so on the one hand, you can talk about retail, meaning everything that consumers spend. That would include cars and gas and houses. Not quite what we talk about when we talk about the retail apocalypse that's happening right now with sort of physical stores that sell apparel, clothes. But retail, as far as we know it, accounts for about 1 in 9, 1 in 10 jobs in the U.S. economy. And for most of the latter half of the 20th century was one of the most important job engines. As we move from being a manufacturing economy to a services economy, you saw an enormous amount of growth in the retail space. It was a really, really important place to create new work and to both and to fill out America spatially. We had an enormous growth in stores in the 1990s and 2000s. But what we're seeing right now is a bit of a reversal, and it's coming because of a lot of trends that have been ongoing for a bit. One, you know, obviously the growth of Amazon, the growth of e-commerce, but also I think we just built too much retail space, and as a result, you're having a contraction, a right sizing that is hurting this sector, which had been a growth engine for so long.
Derek used the word apocalypse. David, what word would you use to describe the retail industry today?
Well, I think it's certainly going through a reshaping and a downsizing and a downturn. And just to build on what Derek said, I think we're seeing new forms of retail now, Marty. In particular, we're seeing a decoupling or a separation of locations where people get information about goods and services and where they actually buy them. So in the old days, those two functions happened under the same roof. So I go into Macy's, I have a conversation with a salesperson, I try on a bunch of stuff, I buy it and I take it away. The new model of retail is more like a Tesla automobile store or Bonobos showroom, right, where you go in, you have this very deep experience with the brand in a small footprint space, but there's nothing that you can actually take away with you. And the logistics now and the fulfillment is done through e-commerce. So I think that's a trend that we're going to see. And even the big giants like Amazon are going to be getting into that.
In fact, I was reading today that I think Walmart is interested in Bonobo. What does that tell us, David?
Well, yeah, very interesting. Actually, Derek and I were just chatting about that a little bit earlier. So as you may know, Mark Laurie, who sold his company Jet.com to Walmart, is now very much in charge of e-commerce there. And he's been buying up e-commerce brands like ModCloth, and the rumor now is that Bonobos is the next one to go. So I think he's looking for companies in the retail space that have established brands and customer bases that he can put the Walmart muscle behind.
Derek, let me go back to you, and the intro was about Sears, JCPenney, and Macy's. That's been the headline for the last week or so. Why have they taken such a hit when you see stores that also sell what appears to be almost everything? You've got Target, TJ Maxx, you've got Costco, you've got these big box stores. Why these three retailers have taken such a hit?
That's a really good question, and it is absolutely true that it's the department stores that have taken the biggest hit. Why? There's a couple different theories. I think one is simply that these were stores that were the Amazons of their time. Sears, when they invented the catalog business, essentially invented the proto-Amazon business model, which was you can get absolutely anything that you want from a book. Well, now it's a MacBook, or it's the iPhone. You can get whatever you want from the technology on your couch, and that's why. So just as you've seen Amazon grow, I think, 5X since 2010, I mean, it's amazing. Sears' revenue per year is about $20 billion. Amazon, therefore, has grown by three Sears in 6 years. So essentially, I think what you're seeing is that Amazon has just proven itself to be a better department store, a better everything store than the everything stores that we had all over the country. So they most directly compete with Amazon, and that's why they've really been in the crosshairs in the last few years.
Does it also tell us about the people who shop there? And I'm assuming if we're talking Sears, JCPenney, and Macy's, they're middle-class shoppers, would you say, Derek?
Yeah, I think they're middle-class shoppers. I think you're absolutely saying, Walmart, has had, good quarters and bad quarters, but isn't yet closing as many stores as JCPenney and Sears. It seems to be doing well on the lower end. You've still seen a pretty large, healthy growth of dollar stores and discount stores, even in terms of physical retail space, despite the fact that these middle-tier companies are falling. I think one way to think about it is, for a long time in the U.S. economy, we talked about the hallowing bottoming out of the economy. You saw growth in the number of jobs for low-income people. You saw growth in the number of jobs in high income. But the middle was being hollowed out. In a way, you could say that that's exactly what's happening right now in the retail space. You have both a growth in the low end, a growth in discount stores. On the high end, you still have some flashy stores, some sort of high revenue per square foot stores that are doing well. But it's in the middle that's really being crushed as sort of consumers move to either one end or the other, or simply replace their shopping by logging onto their smartphone or computer and having that product shipped to them.
Well, let me pick up on that. And David, since you teach at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, the King of Prussia Mall, everyone knows a sprawling mall just outside of the city, has added this really high-end wing with all these flashy stores that Derek was just talking about. I mean, I always think of that mall as kind of like the game of Monopoly. You've got the Baltic Avenues, you've got the Marvin Gardens, and now it looks like we've got the Boardwalk and Park Place of this particular mall. What does that tell us? And perhaps it tells us what Derek just described.
Yeah, I really think so. I think what it tells us exactly is that there are also certain areas where e-commerce has not been as highly penetrated. So if you think about Amazon, for example, the growth has been phenomenal. But one area that they've yet to conquer, and I say yet because who wants to bet against Amazon, is the very, very high end, the luxury, the apparel. And, you know, you have other platforms there that people like Farfetch that essentially aggregate boutiques. So I think what we're seeing at the King of Prussia Mall is kind of a doubling down on what is a physical space really good for. And what it's good for is it's good for great experience and it's good for human interaction. And as long as those two things are still valued by people, we still like to go to bars. You know, it's more fun for me to sit here across from Derek, meet him in person and chat to him rather than just have a purely email conversation. So as long as we can think about what a great experience might look like, and perhaps that's easier to convey that with something that has a little bit of cachet or luxury. And if we go way back to one of the greatest bets in retail history, we only have to look at the Apple Store. You know, back in the 1990s, what business did a computer manufacturer have getting into the space of retail? Well, retrospectively, we can say that was absolutely brilliant for what it did for the brand and the customer experience. So my guess is that's what they're going for with the changes out there.
But it sounds like you're also saying, David, is that I don't know what percentage of shoppers want that analog, that tactile experience. Is that still true?
Yeah, I think if we look at some of the new brands that are coming out now, Marty, so, you know, Warby Parker would be one with eyewear, you know, Away with luggage. What they've been very successful at doing is just creating a space that you actually want to go into. For example, in New York City, if you go into a Rebecca Minkoff store, one of the first things they're going to offer you is a glass of champagne or a cup of coffee.
I have to go there. I haven't been there
yet. Yeah, no, the philosophy that Yuri and Rebecca have is, if you were coming to my house, Marty, I'm not going to just like leave you at the door and, you know, hustle you around. I'm going to offer you something. So I think the brands that really understand experience and the customer experience and the journey and the touch points. And I'll just throw in another little bit of retail history, too. There's a fellow, I believe, based in New York City. He wrote a quite prescient book called Why We Buy, The Science of Shopping, Paco Underhill.
Oh, sure.
And what he and his team did, essentially is follow people around, almost like anthropologists, and notice what they did. Well, if I'm Amazon, I'm collecting tremendous data about you through your electronic stream, but there's still things I can learn about you if I can physically see you and physically see you interact with the product and service. And so companies like Bonobos and Warby Parker and their Genesis use their head offices to double as showrooms where customers learn about employees and vice versa. So I think that's where we're going.
Well, we are talking about the shopping experience, and we want to know, how do you shop? And you can give us a call to our comment line, or you can text us 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with David Bell, he's marketing professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Also with Derek Thompson, senior editor for The Atlantic, where he writes about economics. And again, we want you to join our conversation. Derek, you mentioned the fact that we overbuilt shopping malls, and it is interesting to go into ones where you see, you know, some of these big stores that have closed their doors, and it is a very different kind of experience. David was talking about the shopping experience. It's more than just buying things. Maybe it's hunting and gathering. I don't know how anthropological we want to get with all of this. But how important do you think that experience is for a shopper?
I think there's two things to say that are really important here. First, I think it's, you know, David had this lovely thing where he said stores do two things. They do information, marketing, and they do fulfillment, purchasing. There was a long time when physical stores had a monopoly on both functions. If you wanted to figure out what to buy, you went to a store. If you wanted to buy something, you also went to a store. But now you have the internet replacing both. You can shop for stuff online and then buy it in a store, or you can go to a store and look for stuff and then buy it online. So even if stores still do have a purpose, they still don't have 100% of those information and fulfillment markets that they used to have in the 1990s, and that's why you're seeing a necessary correction in the sheer amount of physical space required to fulfill American retail. Now, about just the sheer amount of space that we have, there's about 1,200 malls in America today. There are some estimates that say that in a decade, given the pace of decline, we might see about 900 malls. Hmm. That's still a lot of malls,
sure.
But a 25% correction is a really, really terrible thing for a lot of these department stores and a lot of these companies that have really, really thin profit margins and need that 25%. There was some interesting research by Cohen Research that found that by one measure, a shopping center gross leasable area, the U.S. has 40% more shopping space per person than Canada.
Wow.
5 times more than the U.K., 10 times more than Germany. Now, like, I've been to the U.K. They seem to be able to clothe themselves. They have cars. They have furniture. They
but not as much as we have, apparently.
Not as much as we have, but they have 5 times more shopping space per capita. So the point is not that we are necessarily in for a Britannization of American retail space, but it just shows that even with a 25% correction or even a larger correction, we can still have enough retail space to allow for a slowly growing retail economy.
David, let me pick up on several things, but I'm also thinking about that individual, we often call the mom and pop stores, not necessarily owned or run by mom and pop, but we're talking about individual stores that perhaps they sell clothing or it's a hardware store, you know, that's not part of some big franchise. What do they have to do to keep up, to stay competitive, to stay relevant?
Well, I think one thing that's kind of on their side, if they can get on board with this, is the fact that people still do a lot of their shopping locally. And in addition, because we're all carrying around our mobile phones, we become more captive to our local environment. So if I were really in need for a hammer, you know, if my local hardware store shows up on my phone at the point of need, then that can also be a place where I might fulfill the product. So I think some of the platforms we've seen, Marty, I mentioned earlier, the platform, Farfetch. So Farfetch or ShopTeeks, what they literally do in the apparel space is they connect boutiques all around the world. So I could go online, I can shop in a store in Spain or the Czech Republic or wherever and buy a pair of jeans and have it shipped to me. So I think the way out for those local stores is either to become embedded in a mobile-enabled platform or to use the power of sort of local marketing and some of the tools that the big providers like Google and so on offer. Those are the two things that we can do, because the data still shows that most of our discretionary expenditure, I'll pick up on Derek here, most of his discretionary expenditure is probably happening within a fairly close radius of where he lives in the lower part of Manhattan. So that's what those guys have to get on board with.
In fact, one of the things, Derek, that you were writing about recently is that more people are spending more money on things like restaurants and more social experiences than they are on a pair of blue jeans.
It's true. You know, we've heard a lot. There's been a lot of talk about a shift from, you know, materialism to experience since the Great Recession. This idea that in the 1990s and 2000s, coolness was essentially how big the logos were on your shirt. This is when Abercrombie's A's were becoming, you know, like 7 feet tall. And if you were wearing like a polo shirt, the man on the horse was like the entire size of your torso. That's clearly changed since 2008 when, because you saw a lot of families suffering, it just became less cool, less socially appropriate to wear enormous logos. At least this is what a lot of both psychologists and marketers have told me. And so I went into the government data to look at maybe where that money was going. And it's pretty clear that for most of the 1990s and 2000s, clothing stores grew a lot faster than restaurants and bars. Mm. But something happened in the middle of the 2000s and accelerated after 2008. Restaurants and bars cars are now growing 50% faster than all non-food retail. So what you're seeing is that this restaurant renaissance, which I think seems to a lot of people to be on its face true. You know, like Philadelphia is having, you know, a renaissance, and New York and Los Angeles and New Orleans, like every single city I go to seems to think that they're having, you know, their own very special moment. But it's truly a national trend. And I think what, you know, if you're looking at, you know, what's going to happen to these spaces, what's going to happen to these empty stores, some of them might become restaurants. And the challenge for malls might be, how do we anchor our stores not with a Macy's or a JCPenney, but maybe with a movie theater attached to a really, really great series of restaurants that people want to come to. And then when they spill out the doors after dessert, cannot help but buy that pair of shoes.
I've always wondered with logos why the consumer is not paid to buy the shirt, considering they're essentially doing advertising for, you know, the guy on the horse, if I can put it
that
way.
It was a wonderful confluence of interest because, they wanted to be seen with the horse on their shirt, and the horse wanted to be seen by other people.
David, about a minute before our break here, do you think that, and picking up on something you said earlier about the sort of loyalty and getting customers inside these mom and pop stores, do you think they're savvy enough and even have the kind of technological wherewithal to be able to access this important, obviously important technology?
Well, I think the good news is that they don't necessarily have to be, Marty, because there are other people out there figuring out ways to do platforms that are going to connect them. So I'll just pick up on what Derek said. I think he's absolutely right. People now are following experiences more than possessions. So we have a student at the Wharton School who's just starting a company where what he does is he will bring you by Uber to bars in Los Angeles. The bar will pay for the Uber ride. You'll have a couple of drinks in there. And then when you leave, you'll just swipe on your phone. You won't even have to pay your tab because everything will be done through technology. So that bar will get more customers. People won't drink and drive. And everybody makes a little bit of money and everybody's happier and people explore more in the process. So I think the good news for the mom and pops, so there are people like this fellow Andrew in my class who's thinking of ways to make you more productive. So there's help out there for you.
Well, let's take that short break. My jaw just went open. You can't see that on the radio. That's David Bell joining us along with Derek Thompson. We're talking about the retail sector of our economy. We want to know how you buy, how you shop. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about our changing shopping habits and how that is changing the retail industry. And again, our guests are Derek Thompson, senior editor for The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, and David Bell. He's a marketing professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, both of them joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Let me read a couple of emails that we've gotten. One from Judy. She says, I worked in a department store for 25 years. I cannot shop in a department store. There's too much selection there and often not well organized. I prefer small stores with a vision and direction so that I can spend time in the store where I might find the merchandise that interests me. That's an interesting comment. Derek, do you want to weigh in on that? I mean, talking about the kind of experience of shopping that people seem to want.
Sure. I compare the shopping that I do online versus offline, and it's just so much more focused online. When I want to buy a pair of socks from J. Crew, I go on to jcrew.com and I buy a pair of socks. When I want to buy a pair of socks from a J. Crew store, I often find myself wandering around. I take in the wood panel, and I find a shirt that I like, and then I see a polo shirt that I like, and I put it all together, and I end up trying on 17 things I didn't necessarily want to buy.
Right.
That's a fabulous thing for the store itself, right? Those auxiliary purchases, those things you didn't know you wanted to buy, that's how the stores make money. But from the individual's perspective, from the individual shopper's perspective, it's not a very efficient experience. And so I think that, you know, one of the benefits of online shopping is efficiency. But if the entire economy became as efficient as possible when it came to finding and buying things, then there would be lots of companies that would be put out of business very quickly. So I think this just goes to sort of the heart of the question, what do people want from shopping? If what they want is an afternoon of wandering around and imagining themselves in different dresses and shoes, that's one thing. And clearly there are millions of people who want that. But there are also millions of people who, when they want a button-up shirt, just want to go to Bonobos and buy one button-up shirt and be done with it and get on with their day.
the kind of shopping, hunting, and gathering I think I was referring to earlier. Let me read an email from Jim. He says, a large part of the decline of retailers is poor management. I would prefer to buy in person, but I continuously cannot find the products I want, so I'm forced to order online. In the case of Sears, even if they have what you want, the ordeal of actually buying it is not worth the trouble. That's an interesting comment. A question from a listener. What about grocery stores? Are local grocery stores struggling? David, have you looked at that?
Well, I think I'll quote one of my colleagues at the Wharton School. Pete Fader is a friend and a great guy. He always used to joke that, you know, the percentage of groceries sold online in 2017 is roughly what it was in 1817. That's sort of one space that e-com hasn't made too much of an inroad into, but for margin reasons, for touch and feel products, maybe people like to pick out the avocados. But I think those kinds of local stores, maybe the model that Derek mentioned earlier, the buy online, pick up in store, is a hybrid space. Of course, we're also seeing the reimagining of what groceries look like. People now, instead of going out and buying a bag of groceries, you go to Blue Apron, who sends you just the right amount of stuff. Because part of the problem with a grocery store as it currently is the mapping, if you like, between groceries that you buy and meals that you eat is not complete. You want to make a Niçoise salad, you need 3 eggs, you don't need 12, and so you end up throwing out 9 that just went bad. So there's a lot of inefficiency in the way grocery stores are run and imagined. So I think we'll see a lot of transformation there, and maybe it's around things like a Blue Apron and so on, and just the way those stores are going to be organized.
Well, we know, Derek.
Go ahead, Derek. Sure. I would just add that you know, I wrote a little bit about supermarkets a few months ago, and it goes right to David's point, which is that this is a segment that used to have a monopoly and now is being fragmented by the rise of specialty grocery stores and also by discount stores. I think something like 4 out of 5 grocery or food selling stores that have been opened in the U.S. since 2013 have been dollar and convenience stores, which goes to show just how desperate consumers are to buy the very cheapest thing possible and the very fastest thing to consume since the Great Recession. But the other thing that's happening, and this goes right back to our retail story, is that we've seen an enormous shift since the early 1990s between what the government calls food at home, groceries that you buy and produce and prepare at home, versus food away, which is the government's term for restaurants and bars. In 2015, for the first time ever, according to one economist, spending at restaurants and bars equals spending at grocery stores. And so what you've really seen, once again, is a surge in restaurants and bars that is happening not only among millennials, but is actually growing fastest among senior citizens. So again, we see a little bit of a shift from retail and a little bit from groceries toward the food away experience.
Are we also seeing, David, a boom in delivery jobs, whether it's trucks, you know, delivering packages or perhaps meals? I've seen Uber drivers or even people, what appears to be in their own personal cars, making deliveries sometimes on a Saturday, even sometimes on a Sunday.
Yeah, I think, you know, the whole infrastructure that's being built up around delivery is absolutely fascinating. I'll relay an example. I was out in LA last year. I was going to an event in September. A friend of mine who lived quite far from the hotel in which I was staying had tickets for me for this HBO event. So rather than go out there, I just ordered an UberX to her house. She gave the tickets to the fellow, and he brought them to me. So I think we're going to see a lot of innovation there around delivery, and again, particularly in food. Companies like Seamless, you know, have got Deliveroo that's really taking off over in Europe. And so, yeah, just the notion of anything, anywhere, anytime. Of course, Amazon is a driving force here with Prime Now. I don't know if you've seen these videos, Marty, this fellow in Tennessee. He wanted to eat waffles for breakfast. So, you know, at 7:19, he places an order for waffle mix, some syrup and a waffle iron. And, you know, by 7:40, he's cooking them up at home because Prime Now has delivered the whole thing. So, yeah.
I don't know. That's a lot of gas mileage for a waffle, don't you think, David?
It is.
Not to put a damper on our conversation here, but it does sort of seem inefficient. Derek, you wrote a really interesting article about self-driving cars, how they could be or maybe perhaps even will be changing this retail shopping, maybe even malls. And a couple of years ago, I thought self-driving cars, that's never going to happen. I have to say, you can see it beginning to happen. How do you see that changing then the retail experience?
Well, this is it begins with a bit of a philosophical observation, which is that self-driving cars are real estate. Once you have essentially a room on wheels that is moving around, powered by any sort of system, either municipal or consumer-driven, then once you see self-driving cars as real estate, then it makes sense that once they become relatively cheap, safe, and plentiful, retail and logistic companies are going to buy up tens of thousands, seeing that they can essentially be stores and that streets themselves are the ultimate real estate as well. And so I do think that self-driving cars could essentially become a new form of shopping space that, for example, rather than go walk to CVS, have CVS drive to you, an actual CVS car that is holding within it merchandise that when you press the CVS button on your phone, it pulls up and you grab the toothbrush and the toothpaste right out of there. Or, for example, think about the challenge of a luxury watch company that wants to function in Midtown Manhattan but can't afford the real estate on Fifth Avenue. Well, they can afford maybe a little truck, a little self-driving car that could drive around that that neighborhood and then pull right up to somebody when they want to take a look at some of the new watches. So again, this is a futuristic vision of the future that is a lot of regulatory decisions away from becoming a reality. But I do think that autonomous retail could be as disruptive for the business as the internet has been.
But that reminds me of the town peddler of you know, centuries past, David Bell.
Yeah, I think, you know, sort of everything that's old is new again, you know, just related to that, Marty. I think the internet has been a great place for the specialist. You know, if we think about, you know, people with young children might have been, I know it's been closed down now, more likely to buy stuff from diapers.com, or I'm more likely to get my razors from harrys.com than to go to a general merchant, because I have this feeling that that the specialist is the one that really knows the product category, just like maybe a few hundred years ago there was a particular person who made the bread and someone else had the meat and someone else was the tailor. So the internet is an ecosystem that has allowed those specialists to have a voice and a platform, and some of them to do very well.
Let me read some more comments. An email from Rob. He says, I can't see buying meat or produce online until Amazon can match local prices for non-perishable supermarket items. I'm buying these in person. I typically buy more durable items and clothing online. However, I feel more comfortable buying appliances in person. Easy free shopping or easy free shipping makes clothes buying online way more convenient than in person. I think, Rob, an example of what we're talking about, which is maximum choice, Derek. I mean, it seems that you can be a highly selective shopper consumer these days and get what you want.
Right, which makes it really, really difficult for a lot of individual brands to be successful sort of trying to build a company around the power of the brand when you have these platforms which essentially represent many, many, many different brands that they can compete with on price. So I think that there's two things that he said that are interesting. One that I totally agree with, which is that I find shopping to be much more convenient online when it comes to clothes, especially with free shipping and return policies. That really, really makes it risk-free. It makes it such that, you know, you can have someone spend $300, $400 on dresses and essentially say, well, it doesn't even matter. If I don't like the dresses, I can just ship it right back and the money will go right back into my credit card. I mean, that is really, really risk-free shopping. The second thing I would say is that on the one hand, of course, it's true that it seems a little bit weird to buy like a ribeye steak online.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, I just started using Blue Apron because I had no idea how to cook. And at my age, I felt like that was a demerit to me. And so I started using Blue Apron, and it is remarkable how efficient it is at getting me, you know, chicken and meat and fish, which arrives in a cardboard box, cooled and ready to go right into my refrigerator, where 5 days later I can cook it and it's delicious. So there are logistic solutions to some of these problems, and some of them are just as simple as devising a kind of cooling pack that you just put right on top of the meat so that by the time it arrives, it is as cool as it would be if you walked into your Kroger or something and picked it right off of the shelf. So, or right behind the window. So I do think that a lot of these problems are merely one logistical answer away from being solved by an e-commerce company.
Yeah, and I think just to follow on from that, the other thing that that came out very interesting from the listener's point is products that have what we call non-digital attributes, things that you have to touch, feel, smell, they are hard to sell online because I don't really know what the avocado is going to be like or the steak is going to feel like. But I think just as Derek talked about autonomous cars, there's maybe even a technology solution for that, Marty. I have a colleague at the University of Pennsylvania who's working on tactile sensing. You can put your hand in a glove and you could feel, you know, what a steak might actually feel like. Or maybe there's a video way to do it. Maybe your computer will emit other kinds of sensory things in the future. So I think somebody will crack the problem of products that have tactile and non-digital that are extreme, things like food.
Right. Or even, I would say,
isn't that virtual? Almost that, like, no, go ahead, Derek.
I was going to say, right, I mean, so you have, there's a haptic solution, which is that there's the possibility of putting on a glove and having an experience to your hand that is just like touching the meat or feeling the ripeness of the avocado. But there's also a solution that we're essentially talking about information, right, which is, to go right back to David's wonderful first point, one of the two functions of a store, information plus fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And there are many ways to get information. One is by actually feeling the meat, but another would be by, you know, reading, say, a 1 to 10 rating of what the meat looks like. And if the actual meat arrives in a form that is unlike that which you expected, then there could simply be a policy the company has where they pay you right back the money if you're unsatisfied by the ribeye. So again, these are solutions that A, could be technologically solved, but B, could just be solved by a policy which says if the fish arrives and you don't like the fish, we'll just pay you back for the fish. The end.
Is that sort of borderline virtual reality in terms of this sort of tactile experience of this steak that you're going to buy?
Well, I suppose, David? That's another thing. Yeah, another thing, Marty, that may be coming down the line. You know, is you just put on a pair of glasses and you're in some immersive experience and you can sort of sense and feel things. I mean, you know, an early version of something like this is what they have in Korea, Marty, where you're waiting for the subway and there's a whole wall of items that you can buy in the supermarket and you just scan the QR code while you're waiting for the train and then you get home and the groceries have arrived.
Oh,
so,
no, really? That exists?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, Tesco does that in Korea. It does exist, yeah. Wow.
A comment from a listener. Can they comment on fast food restaurants doing delivery? Derek, do they do that? Is that on the horizon?
I actually don't know a whole lot about fast food companies doing delivery. I don't know if David does.
I have to say not so much directly. We did have a former student who's doing very well in Europe with a company called Deliveroo, where he's delivering not from fast food, but sort of the next level up of independent restaurants and providing delivery infrastructure. But yeah, I could imagine if there's people like to eat McDonald's and KFC, why not deliver it to their house? The margins would be thin, but maybe there's upselling and other things that happen there.
And Derek, are reviews, are they influential when it comes to shopping decisions?
They're certainly going to be influential. I mean, reviews, again, are information and advertising, and information advertising is most effective when the consumer doesn't know a whole lot. So I think that, you know, reviews for something like, you know, 11 Madison or something isn't going to do much because it has a brand and no one is necessarily going to the reviews to learn about the brand. But for, you know, if you're in a dense urban environment and there are like 17 taco places within a 1 mile radius and you don't know which one is the best and all of their names are familiar, then yeah, the way that you're going to filter that decision is probably by going on to Yelp and figuring out, you know, which one's the 4.7 and which one's the 4.4. Reviews, I think, are you know, reviews online, just like information from your friends, just like the power of brand names. All of these are pieces of information advertising that spill into that stew that sort of cooks up each decision. I think in particular in really competitive markets, reviews can be a difference maker.
Yeah, and also I think, Marty, just to add to that, reviews that are written by people with whom you affiliate or you feel associated with. So if I travel outside of Philadelphia to San Diego and I read a restaurant review in San Diego written by a Philly person, I'm more likely to pay attention to it because I feel that person has reviewed from a basis of Philadelphia restaurants like me. So reviews that are written by people with whom I can relate, that's the extra layer I think that's important there.
We're almost out of time here, Derek. We began by talking about the retail sector shedding jobs, some of these department stores closing some of their stores. Do you see that continuing into the future, Derek?
Yeah, I do. I think that right now we're seeing a situation where the rolling news of store closing seems to be continuing. I just looked at a Credit Suisse report that suggested that if they continue at the same pace as the first 3 months this year, we're looking at the single worst year for retail closings this century. So it is not a good time for physical retailers, but the overall retail space continues to grow, and some companies are definitely going to benefit.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Time. Derek Thompson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's senior editor for The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, wrote a book called The Hitmakers. David Bell, thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times, even though you're up there
pleasure.
In New York.
And that's okay.
And he's marketing professor at the Wharton School at Penn, wrote a book called Location is Still Everything. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.